Okay, well, except for Job's life. Beyond that, all is right with the world. Good. We are in Perek Chet, chapter 8. This is Bildad week. We're going to see if we can get through Bildad's first speech in the session today. Last week we introduced him. We talked about him speaking second. We talked a little bit about his style, being a very terse and direct style. He has metaphor, but he does not really go into flowery language. If at some point you feel like the microphone is needed, I'll use it. But right now the construction seems to be behaving itself, so we'll see. Comparing the words of Eliphaz and Bildad, we said Eliphaz really offered the vision of a way to divine favor, a way to a good life, whereas Bildad's words are really focused much more on justifying what God does and saying that everything that God does is fair and is just. We also noted from Maimonides in his Guide of the Perplexed that Eliphaz believes that everything is just and fair, but Bildad is going to say that it is all just and fair in the end. But it's possible that someone will suffer and then be paid for it, so to speak, in the future, and we'll get to that. And then a third point from Rabbeinu Bachya in his Kad HaKemach, he noted that Bildad is stronger than Eliphaz in his criticism of Job, where Eliphaz so far has been veiled, and it won't be until Eliphaz's third speech that he's going to come out and say, "Job, I think that you're a terrible person." Whereas, you know, Bildad said, or seemed to say, that Job's children have sinned, kind of flat out. So Bildad's speech is going to be something that's going to push Job further. And we'll see that very clearly as we go into it. We start out, Vayan, we're in chapter 8, sentence 1. If you're using the stone Tanakh, you want page 1631. Vayan Bildad Ashuchi Bayomar, and Bildad the Shuchite declared and said, I think we discussed Shuchi in the very beginning when we introduced the three friends. I don't remember even at this point any specific comments that we made, other than to say that we don't really know where he is from. Ad'an tamalel eila v'ruach kabir imrei ficha. He says, how long are you going to say these things? How long are you going to bring a mighty wind with the words of your mouth? Which we noted last time, because we commented on this verse last time, that this is a direct response to Job chapter 6, sentence 26, in which Job called the words of Eliphaz ruach, empty wind. And so now Bildad comes along and says, I'm calling your words empty wind. So there, a very mature discussion. Sentence 3 is where it really picks up. He says, Hakel yaveit mishpat. Will God corrupt justice? V'im Shaddai or Shakai, as we usually pronounce it, Shin Dalet Yud is a name of God. V'im Shakai yaveit tzedek. Or will God corrupt righteousness? Are you trying to tell me that God is going to take that which ought to be straight and make it crooked? That's the challenge that he puts to him, which has shades of Eliphaz's comment when Eliphaz said, "Ha'enosh me'elokai yitzdak." Can a person be more righteous than God? So he's asking a similar question. Is it really within your pay grade to say that God is corrupting justice and righteousness? There are actually, though, two approaches that you can take to this. One approach you can take to this is that he's serious. He's being 100% serious, Bildad. And what he's saying is, you say God should leave you alone, and what's happening shouldn't be, and God is unjust, right? And what I am saying to you is that that's impossible. That's one take. But there's another take, and this is something which is going to continue to challenge us as we go through the book, and we have to sort of keep it all in our heads. Is the construction noise a problem, or are we okay still? Okay, I'm hearing it. I don't know if you're hearing it. The challenge that we have throughout this book, and I sort of waffled in the beginning about whether I was going to bring it in, but I think I sort of have to give it an honest read, is that there are two different views all the way through the book of what Job is claiming. The simple literal read of most of what we've said is that Job is saying, God has done this to me, and it is unjust. And so Eliphaz and now Bildad will come back to him and say, no, what God is doing is just, it's your perception or whatever else. That's one take. The other take is that Job is saying, it can't be that God would be this unjust to do these things to me. Rather, God has outsourced running the universe to the stars, and what the stars are doing to me is unjust. And by that read, when Job said in the previous chapter, why would God pay attention to me? I'm such a lowly figure. He wasn't saying, God, you're wasting your time by paying attention to me. He's saying, God isn't paying attention to me. I'm such a lowly figure. God isn't paying attention at all. And your philosophy that says that God is doing all of this is mistaken. It's not so. You follow the two different views of what Job is saying? Either Job is saying God is doing this and it's corrupt, or he's saying God is not doing it and it's corrupt. Either way, he's not happy. Make no mistake. But the question is, what is he blaming God for? Is he blaming God for doing things that are bad directly? Or is he blaming God for putting something in charge that is going to do bad things? Yes.
I'm sorry. No. In view of the frame with Satan and God coming to this agreement, he's right.
In other words, God has put something else in charge. Interesting. What he is claiming God put in charge is not the Satan.
I understand, but he's sensing that something is amiss.
Interesting. It's a good point. In fitting this in with the section in the beginning, the second view has Job being correct, but the first view does also. It's just that the first view is less of an outsourcing view. It's more that God has himself chosen to do this as opposed to God doing it. I'm sort of feeling like the truth of things is a third thing, which has elements of both. You know? In other words, the truth is that God agreed to the Satan's challenge. On the one hand, that's like the first view, that he's claiming that God is actively doing this. God made a decision to cause Job harm. Whether he's doing it personally or because Satan has put a challenge doesn't really matter so much. It's God's decision to have this event take place. Whereas it's similar to the second view in that it really is an outsourcing because it's based on Satan's will. It's based on Satan's desire that this should happen, and it's going to happen in this way because God doesn't decide what it is that's going to happen. He just empowers him, do what you want within these parameters. So really the truth has the elements of both.
I think the fact that he suspects that something is wrong with the universe.
Yeah.
Is correct.
There were a couple of
hands. I have a question probably you can't answer.
Great.
Is astrology stuff?
Where do you see astrology?
Well,
you mean what I'm talking about? No, absolutely. Absolutely, it is astrology. The claim.
That's terrifying.
Why?
That's complete superstition. Not faith.
Why does Job? Why do we hold Job to a standard of not being superstitious?
I don't know.
No, in all seriousness. First of all, keep in mind, astrology only becomes superstition in a relatively modern era. We accept and recognize that there are forces in the universe that we cannot see by which things operate on other things from afar. Right? We call some of them gravity. You know, as an example, if you want to get technical, we can talk about quantum entanglement. Like, there's stuff going on that we can't see. And they understood that there was stuff going on they couldn't see and came to the conclusion that these mighty things, and when I say they, I'm not talking Tanakh, I'm talking human beings at various times in history, that these powerful entities that are up there in the heavens are assigned the ability to act on what's going on Earth in these remarkable ways that, yes, are identified as astrology. Now, historically, going back to Talmudic times, many Jewish authorities absolutely believed in the power of astrology. Maimonides stands out as somebody who did not 1,000 years ago, or 800 and something years ago. But the idea of it as a whole wasn't a crazy idea, and therefore for somebody who is presented to us in Tanakh, to believe in it, right, isn't bizarre. It's funny, but it's not bizarre. Keep in mind, especially, now I'm going to add to that, the people who read, I'm getting to Sharon, don't worry, the people who believe in the second approach to this book, the people who believe that Job is arguing that it's all astrology and that God had outsourced it and all that, believe that Job is wrong. In other words, from their perspective, what this book is about is defeating the idea of astrology. Those who put it, I think, more succinctly and more correctly, those who bring astrology into this book do so in order to defeat it, not in order to uphold it. The argument is that the way that they read it is, Job is saying the only way such terrible things could be happening is if God isn't watching and he's left it to the stars to run the show and to the planets to run the show. And that the three friends are trying to teach Job that it's not true, that God has not outsourced it. And Job is in the wrong within this view of the book. So that, I think that's an important clarification. Sharon.
Yeah, just whatever it is, whatever he thinks he doesn't like what God is doing, he's not happy with you either.
I don't blame him. Yes, I think that's a fair statement. So what we have then is these two different schools of thought in explaining what Job is saying, right? Again, one school of thought is, God is doing terrible things to me, and the other school of thought is, God has left it to somebody else who is doing terrible things to me. So depending on which one I take, that will determine what Bildad's response here is. Either Bildad's response is to the first approach. You're saying God is doing terrible things to you, and I am saying it can't be that God is doing terrible things without justice. There is justice to whatever it is that's happening. That's one approach. Or you are saying that the stars run the world, and you're saying that God left it to the stars. That in and of itself is an accusation of injustice, because leaving it to the stars would be unjust. And that I bring you for that I bring you source number one on the sheet. This is Malbim's introduction to the chapter. Malbim is in that camp, along with Ralbag, along with Maimonides, that says that Job is a proponent of astrology, and Job believes that God has outsourced everything. So this is Bildad's response. Here, take a look at number one. Iyov hechlit ki hanhagazot yotzeit mimoshel iver ustum einayim shehi ha'maracha. Iyov decided that this governance of the universe comes from a ruler who is blind, whose eyes are sealed, meaning the constellations, because the constellations are automatic. There are not, I should add this to our astrology canon here. The theory of astrology that's being put forth in Job's name is not that Mars is conscious and deciding, I want to reward this one or punish that one, but rather that God simply gave each of these entities a certain influence, and as the planets go around and as whatever constellations are in control shift, that's what determines what's going to happen, but it's entirely automatic.
They're not godless.
Correct. They are not godlets. No, they are God's Shabbos clock, if you will. They're just functioning on a timer and doing whatever they do. That's the idea. It's sort of like, to reduce it to a laboratory situation. On the one hand, in one lab, you have a scientist who is looking at the mouse and doing all sorts of cruel things to the mouse, in the name of science, no doubt. And in the other lab, you have a scientist who has set up various implements which do things to the mouse at specific intervals, which are going to be determined by the functioning of the machines, and the scientist has actually gone for the day, and the machines are just going to do whatever they're going to do. And Malbim's point is that whichever view you adopt, you're still accusing God of cruelty. You haven't solved any problems by taking view number two. So take a look as he goes through it. He says, Job says, it's coming from the blind, sightless ruler, meaning these automatic constellations. Asher hilo tavchin ben oved elokim asher lo avado. The constellations can't tell the difference between somebody who serves God and someone who does not. Omnam, but Bildad hichriya ha-hepech mitzad ha-mishpat ha-rashi ha-klali. Bildad argues the opposite regarding the overall general justice that God brings to this world. And so he says, ha-avel ra'oi she'isulak me'et Hashem. He says, it can't be that you ascribe corruption to God. That doesn't fit. Yana yotochi saron, because that will be a flaw, and God is not flawed. Vihine, shenamar she'Hashem masar hanagat ha'olam el moshel iver ha'bilti machin bein tov l'ra. To say that God assigned control or governance of the world to a blind ruler who cannot tell what's good and what's bad. He says, even if you're going to say that now there's no injustice in a particular event that happened as far as God is concerned, that particular tsunami wasn't God because it was the weather that did it, right? If that's what you're going to claim, you've just pushed the problem back one step, because why'd you leave the weather in charge? Right? It's the same fundamental problem. He says, "B'chol zeh lo nuchal atzdik oto mitzad ha-mishpat ha-rashi." He says, it's still not going to make everything work. It's not going to justify overall justice. Ki nishala lo zeh be'atzmo avel me'ito. Because we'll still ask, well, that in of itself is corruption. Masha masarata anagabi adam ha-racha, assigning governance of the universe into the hands of the constellations. You follow? Okay? If the parent leaves the 10-year-old home alone, and the 10-year-old burns down the house, so the parent didn't start a fire, but the parent left the 10-year-old there. So if God assigns the constellations to run the show, so he's not responsible for the particular disaster, but he's responsible for assigning the constellations to do it. And so Malvim's point is to say that Bildad is saying, this is Bildad's response to Job. So either we take the first view, Job is saying God is guilty of corruption, and Bildad's response is, no, he's not. Or you take the second view, that Job is saying that God has given control of the universe to a corrupt system, and God is responsible for that, and Bildad is saying, no, you can't say that either. You follow? I don't think I've brought in the second idea enough yet, but I've been looking forward to the rest of the book, and I think that I have to. I don't think I have a choice. I didn't want to confuse things, but you really can't read the book without it. Yeah.
So that goes back to what this lady was saying, that God gave the decision to Satan, to this outside force, to these stars, to whatever it is.
But that's a different allegation. But the reason why it's a different allegation is because if you're going to say it's the Satan is a creature with, it's a funny word to use in this context, but conscience. It's a creature that is supposed to know right and wrong because it's been empowered by God to do certain things and only certain things. And it's able to do this and not to do that and to employ logic. The charge regarding the stars is that it's an automated system. You know, remember his point that he made in the beginning of the book. It wasn't really the beginning, but when he first cursed the day he was born. He said, everything's been programmed in from the moment when I was conceived. That determined what the flow of the rest of my life was going to be like. If I take this view that he's charging that the stars are in charge, that's the way to read that line. His critique of the universe is it's all automated. Whereas the Satan is not automated. The Satan has a particular mission and a particular goal in mind. Okay. There are similarities. I just don't think it's through and through. So that's his opening salvo. Bildad's opening salvo is, there is justice. You cannot accuse God of injustice, regardless of what your accusation is. And then, look at this one. This is the verse that we referred to earlier about Bildad's kids. Im banecha chat'u lo. I'm sorry, what did I say, Bildad's? Yeah, Eo's kids. Im banecha chat'u lo, vayishalchem biyad pish'am. Did he just say what I thought he said? Right? If your children sinned, and he sent them in the hands of their sins. There's measure for measure. Not only that, the turn of phrase is an interesting one. He sent them biyad pish'am, in the hands of their sin, or their iniquity. What does that mean? He sent them in the hands of their sin. They did it to themselves. the sin that they committed is what brought this on them. And we see that. Take a look, please, at the source sheet here, the commentary first of Rashi. Source number two. Vayishalchem biyad pisham, he sent them in the hand of their sins. Hapesha hu nasa shaliach lahovilam. I'm sorry, al yidei pisham, via their sins. Hapesha hu nasa shaliach lahovilam. The sin became the agent to bring them to this state. Now, what does that mean? What is Rashi saying? That don't blame God, is what Bildad is saying. It was the sin that did it. If they didn't sin, if they had not sinned, this wouldn't have happened. But it's even stronger than that. Take a look at the next source number three. Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler, who really cements this. He says, playing off of a verse in Kohelet, in Ecclesiastes, he says, Re'ei, she'en ha'dvarim ba'im b'mikre. He says, see that things do not happen by happenstance. Ki'im b'hashgacha l'fi agmul. Things happen by supervision as reward. Ki ka'asher b'necha chat'u, ba'asotam mishtet tamid ha'mevi lidei kalut rosh. He says, when your children sinned, when they made feasts, causing frivolity, Hine az gershom min ha'olam b'mekom pisham, that he chased them, he, God, chased them from the world in the place where they sinned. Because where did they die? In the house, when it collapsed on them, when they were having one of these parties. They're making parties every single day. According to Mitzudat David, reading this biyad pisham, he sent them in the hands of their own sins, Bildad is doing what I would have thought unthinkable. He's turning to the father of the kids who died and saying, well, they died when they were partying. Clearly, they shouldn't have been partying. That's what he said. You can read it right there. That's the allegation.
Why is that unthinkable?
It's unthinkable to say that.
But not to, Job had made the sacrifice. Kim didn't really initiate the sacrificing. He initiated
yes.
the sacrificing. Because he was worried about something that they were thinking or...
Yeah, thinking.
Whatever. He did not know exactly how they thought because he wasn't invited to any of their parties.
Right. I'm not saying that it's unthinkable that a person sins and something bad happens to them. I'm saying it's unthinkable to say that to the father of the kids who were just killed.
But it was unthinkable for the wife. To say, well, go.
Yeah, that wasn't great either.
So.
That wasn't great either. And you know what? Some of what Job was saying was also fairly unthinkable. The reality is that what people here are saying is strong on all counts. All of them are extremists. And they're meant to be extremists. They're teaching us lessons in philosophy. So they're staking out poles. But this is a really harsh pole. From a human perspective, not from a philosophical perspective, from a human perspective. By what right does he do that? I'm sorry, I find this really difficult. Shana, you were going to say, or you're holding yourself back from saying? Okay. But just to finish the line, because Mitzudat David deserves the ending, he says, for they died in the place of the feast. B'mekom haresha sham hamishpat. He's playing with a verse in the third chapter of Ecclesiastes, which there it says, B'mekom hamishpat shama haresha. It's when Ecclesiastes is complaining about injustice. So he says, in the place where there should be justice, there is wickedness. So he's turned it around. In the place where there's wickedness, that's where the justice happened, that they were punished. Okay. So what we're seeing here is according to this read, is an accusation. They were zapped because they did bad things. So there, Job. You're gonna say? No. Okay. However, there's another way to read it. What was the first word in the sentence? Im. Your translations translate the im here in what way? When. I have when here in the stone. If. You have an if? Wait, you're using a stone also.
JPS
has if. Very interesting. You could translate im either way. As a general rule in the Torah, im, meaning in Chumash, im generally means if. But there are three places we are told where im means when. Like, im kesef tale adami, when you lend money to the needy, you follow the following rules. So it's when. It's not if you lend, it's when you lend. And there are two others. But the point is, Malbim says, I don't take this im as when. When your children sinned, then they were given into the hands of their sin. Rather, I read it as if, and I brought it for you in source number 4. He says, Im banecha chat ulau, if your children have sinned against him, she'al banecha lo uchal lomar shenit yasru al derech hatimura, k'del harbot scharam, achar she'im meitu, k'del harbot scharam, achar she'im meitu v'ne'evdu. He says, you know what? Hang on. When I did my translation of this the first time, I made a mistake. I want to see how that changes the meaning of the sentence. Don't look at the English that I have here. Let's read the words straight. He says, I can't say regarding your children that they were punished as an exchange in order to increase their reward. Why? Because they died. And they're lost. You know what? It doesn't make a difference. The translation is incorrect. I'm going to have to adjust it. But it doesn't actually change the meaning of his point. His point is still the same, that it's an if. But what he's saying is, this is the way you should read it. Bildad is about to say, further on in the chapter, Bildad is about to say that sometimes people suffer in order that once they pass whatever test they have to pass, or even without a test, later in life, it will turn out to have caused something good for them. They think it's bad, it's going to turn out to be good. You'll see when he gets into that in one of his metaphors. But what he's saying here is that Bildad is saying, I can't claim that was the case with your children. Because they're gone. They're not going to get whatever benefit it was. He's assuming the benefit is this worldly, not otherworldly. So he says, I can't make that claim that they suffered for an exchange in order to improve their reward since they died. But he says, even as I can't say that, you can't determine that they did not sin. You can't tell me that they didn't sin. But that which relates to you, that you say you're righteous, on that, that I'll respond to you. I can't say whether your kid sinned or not, but I can talk about you. That's the statement he's making. Shana?
I actually like this speech from Bildad a little in the sense that it addresses the children's fate as a result of their own circumstances and not merely as an instrument to afflict Joseph. Which is one of the things that profoundly bothers me about this. Mm-hmm. And we see this in other places, the idea of the suffering of the children is really the instrument to cause the suffering of the parents.
Yep. Agreed. Absolutely agreed. In terms of the fact that this shows up quite a bit within Tanakh. In terms of what he's saying here, I have a very hard time with the idea of the reader, not Bildad. Bildad doesn't know what we know. He doesn't have the bird's eye view. He didn't see the opening part of the book. But given what we know about this story, it's very clear that this is a case of the children suffering in order to harm the parent. That's exactly what's going on. So if Bildad has lucked into Shana's philosophy of the world, it's by mistake.
It doesn't mean that the children do not deserve also to be punished. Because when a child is because of what they did, but the mere fact that they're killed will also make the parents suffer.
Right, we are talking about adult children, and adult children could have done whatever they've done, and Job may not even have any clue, you know, what they have going on in their lives. I mean, I'm not about to discuss the general problem of sins of the parents being visited upon the children. As much fun as the topic is, you know, the word not applies. Yes?
But it still begs that question. Why did Job feel obligated to bring sacrifices every day to atone for the sins that his children might have done?
He doesn't.
Does.
No. Go back to the beginning of the book. I know it's been a long time since we read it, but that's not. But that's not what he does.
Is that
Take a look. Take a look at what he would do. In sentence 5, what did he do? Chapter 1, sentence 5. No, you skipped a word.
When the cycle fast ended, Job would send summons.
Yeah.
He would rise early in the morning and bring his men to
him. Wait. Summon them? No, but he sent to summon them. Vayikad Hashem. I realize that here in the stone they've sort of glossed Vayikad Hashem into summoning, but as he prepared them is a better translation than summon, even within their read. He prepared them, he rose early in the morning and brought the offerings. But the idea of preparing them is that they are engaged in bringing the offering. Otherwise, he could have brought it himself. It's exactly, he's not bringing it in their place. It's they are involved in the offering too. That's a very important point to me, because it's not a phenomenon of...
Then he said, you go take it to the...
Exactly.
That doesn't mean that they were with this carbon, but the sacrifice totally absolved. Maybe they didn't have the right...
From Job's perspective, it does.
He did whatever he could do.
Further, from his perspective, it does. Remember, one of the points that we made was that the disaster befalls his children the day after they have just finished a cycle and they've brought the offerings, and that's meant to shock him. Like, they should be, their slate should be clean. How could this have happened? So that, you know, that does become a part of it. Rita?
He's saying it's a sin to party and enjoy life, and that's the sin they commit.
He's saying that that's what Bildad is suggesting.
That's a sin.
Yeah. He's saying that Bildad is suggesting that it brings about frivolity. Now, whether the frivolity itself is a sin or whether the frivolity leads to a sin, you know, given again, going back to the beginning of the book, the fear that they did something wrong regarding God as a result of having a party. It's not the party per se, it's what the party led to.
Bildad didn't say frivolity, it was Malbim's
read. It's Malbim's read that we're within of
right.
Understanding what Bildad is saying. Well, the question is, what does Bildad mean when he says that they were harmed in the hand of their sin? So what Malbim is doing is he's explaining, leave the word frivolity aside because it doesn't matter. What he's saying is, when Bildad says they were sent in the hands of their sin, what that means is they were punished, but they were punished with what they did. They were at the feast when the house collapsed, and that suggests that the feast is the sin. That's the way he's reading this odd turn of phrase. I don't want to get so hung up on one individual sentence, as much fun as it is to do that, because there's so much to see here. What I wanted to show you here is two ways to take this sentence. One approach to this sentence is it's an accusation. Rashi Mitzudat David. Bildad is saying, your kids sin. Whereas Malbim's read is that he's saying, I don't know whether it was their sin or whether it was your sin, but there's a sin here, and either it was theirs, maybe, but regarding you, I'm going to respond to you. And then he's going to continue with the next sentence, and he says, sentences 5-7, Im ata teshacher el kel ve'el shakai titchanan. If you would turn to God, l'shacher is to pray. Remember that we saw before in the end of chapter 7, v'shichartani ve'eineni. L'shacher, Job turned the word around from its usual meaning of approaching God in prayer to God. He turned it into God coming to seek me. Shichartani, God is going to come looking for me. So he says, Im ata teshacher el kel, if you would pray to God, ve'el shakai titchanan, if you would plead with God, Im zach v'yasharata, if you were truly pure and righteous, ki ata ya'ir alecha, then he would arouse upon you, meaning arouse his mercy upon you, v'shilam nivat tzidkecha, and he would make whole or bring peace to the home of your righteousness. Things would be wonderful if only you would turn to God. And then Pasuk Zion, sentence 7, and then I want to come back to these three verses collectively. V'hayare shitcha mitzar. Your beginning would be viewed as tiny. All the wealth that you had before, the thousands and thousands of different animals and all that, that would be considered tiny. Your end, yisgemeod, would be flourishing. You would have great plenty, even compared to what you once had, if only you would turn to God. So, here, Newsom points out something that I think is sharp. Look at the words that are used here for reaching out to God in sentence 5. Lishacher and lehitchanein. These are words of very strong beseeching. They connote humbling oneself. I gave you in source number 5, we're not going to look it up right now, but two references that show lishacher being used really as a pleading type of a position. What he's saying, what Bildad is saying to Job is, you need to be humble. You're approaching God from a position of pride. I know, and I am righteous, and I understand how the world works, and I know what God is doing. And what Bildad is saying to him is, lose the attitude, Job. Approach God from a position of weakness and move towards God. If you notice this also, the preposition in Pasuk Hay in sentence 5, you have to go to God. You have to move, you have to progress towards God.
So this is what Eliphaz was saying too.
Yes. Eliphaz also said to him he should pray to God. The difference between Bildad and Eliphaz is in the undertone. Eliphaz's statement was, all narrative, all of life fits a narrative, and things can have a happy ending. If you come to God, that will move you to the next step. Bildad is saying, God is just, and what you're saying is wrong. And what you should do is make your behavior right. And when you make your behavior right, then things will be better. It also has the narrative type of an idea, but it's a much less gentle way of framing things. It's much more accusatory, it seems to me, as opposed to trying to present a path towards redemption. Rita?
Well, I agree with that. If someone is a tzaddik, he's supposed to be a tzaddik.
Sure. Well, we did say that. Tam v'yashar yirei Elokim. Not tzaddik, but yeah.
Well, then everything I study about mindfulness and how to approach things, to go to God and ask, what's happening as opposed to the way he's responding. So I agree with that.
Well, two thoughts. Thought number one is, we have to be careful when we recommend things like that to somebody. But thought number two is that I don't think he's saying to him, ask God what's happening. He's saying, turn to God to admit wrongdoing and accept, and to accept what God does. I mean, to summarize what we've seen so far of Bildad in a nutshell in this opening part of his chapter, he has dismissed Job's philosophy, both versions of it, right? Whether his philosophy is God did this unjustly, or his version, or God assigned an unjust automated system of running the universe. And then, having said that Job is wrong, Bildad provides his own explanation for how God can cause people to suffer. And he has begun that by saying bad people get bad things. And now he's going to move on to his next step with his metaphors, because he has more to say about why people suffer.
I'm just saying, challenge, like I find, I start to read the Psalms to connect to God, to bring in some divine guidance. This is what we're taught. And personally, it helps me.
That's good.
So,
I think it's a very healthy way to approach it. Again, I think his approach is much more judgmental. That's the way I see it. But let's take a look now where he goes with this. Sentences 8 to 10 are a bridge section introducing his parables. Ki sha'alna l'dor rishon v'konein l'cheker avotam. When you inquire of the first generation, meaning of our ancestors, and when you prepare yourself l'cheker avotam for the analysis of their ancestors. Okay, go back and ask people from before. I'm going to come back to this sentence. I just want to read 8 through 10 collectively. Ki tmol anachnu velo neda. What did he just say? What did he just say in sentence 9? Ki tmol anachnu velo neda.
Read yesterday's news and we don't even know it.
Oh, not yesterday's news. Different aphorism.
We are out yesterday.
We were born yesterday. I believe this is the source for the thing, you know, when people say, I wasn't born yesterday, right? We were born yesterday, and therefore we don't have a clue. I believe this is the etymology of it. I looked around online and didn't see them giving any etymology for the phrase. They just sort of say, well, this is the phrase. But someone has to edit the articles, because, yeah, I'm pretty sure this is your source. Ki tmol anachnu, we were born yesterday. Right? He said, ask the earlier generations. Prepare yourself to receive the wisdom of the ancients. Because we were born yesterday, and we don't actually know anything. And our days, he says, are like the passing shadow. Right? Passing over. We're like the shadow passing over the land. And he concludes his bridge here. Halohem yorucha yomrulach umilibam yotziu milim. They will guide you. They'll tell you, and from their hearts they will produce words, meaning words of explanation. They're going to teach us the way the universe works. Now, we've already noted that in Eliphaz also said his wisdom was not his own. But where did Eliphaz say he got his wisdom?
A vision,
right. Eliphaz claims to be channeling something prophetic. Bildad has a similar tack in that he says, it's not me, right? I'm not the source of it. But he says his wisdom comes from the ancients. This is another way in which Bildad is presented as a step down from Eliphaz. Eliphaz has prophecy, Bildad has history. We have to see what happens with Zophar. Eliphaz, and another point that's important, Eliphaz likes to refer to himself and what he has seen. If you take a look, I brought it on your sheet, in source number 6. This is from Amos Chacham's commentary to the chapter in the Dan Mikra edition. He says, Gam Eliphaz mistayeya b'dvarav b'masoret. Eliphaz also is helped by tradition in his words. Ela she'Eliphaz kizakein mazkir gam et nisyono shelo. It should be shelo, not shelano. That's a typo on my part, I believe. Double checking, but I'm fairly sure. Yeah, it's Shelo. The typo in the Hebrew, that's all. So, Eliphaz, as an elder, mentions his own experience. Vomer kampamim ra'iti, and he says, I saw. He said, I saw, at least in chapter 4, sentence 8, chapter 5, sentence 3. He says, I've seen this, and I've seen that. That's an Eliphaz approach. Ve'ilu bildare no mazkir tatsma, filu pa'amachat. Bildad doesn't mention himself even once. Not in terms of his experience, not in terms of his personal feelings. Bildad does not refer to himself. He's junior. That's number one. He said, we need to consult the ancients because we haven't seen it all. This is important because of what Bildad's philosophy is going to be. And as we'll see, there are multiple ways to understand Bildad. I'm sorry. But within one of the ways to understand Bildad's philosophy, and to me it's a very convincing read, Bildad makes the claim that a person might suffer now and be rewarded for it far in the future. You just don't know right now why it's happening. And that's consistent with what he's saying here. You know why you have to consult the ancients? Because we haven't seen it. We haven't been around long enough to see the comeuppance of the wicked or to see the reward of the righteous. If you take a look at source number 7, Ralbag makes this point. He says, "Anachnu nitzarech bazel lekabel edut mehem." We must receive testimony from them, from our elders. "Lefi shetmol anachnu v'lo nedaha inyanim asher yitzarchu lizman aroch." He says, we don't know of things that take a long time to transpire. We haven't seen them. We haven't been around. We don't know from experience. We haven't been around long enough for it. Yes, Shana.
But when he talks about reward in the future for the righteous, he's still meaning the reward in this world?
I believe so. Although I was wondering about it as I read it too. Yeah. Unless you're going to say reward for descendants in this world counts, so to speak. If you take a look, just to close the loop on this idea of the elders having seen more, in sentence 10, he had this triple clause at the end. Sentence 10 had Yorucha, they will show you. Yomrulach, they will tell you. Umilibam, Yotzil Milim, and from their own hearts, they will produce words. So Mitzudat David, Rabbi Altshuler says, they will guide you. That's the first verb. They will tell you that which they received. And then from their hearts, they will add their own contribution. So what that means is you have an accumulated wisdom. It's not just they lived longer than we live right now, because I'm in the middle of my life and they lived however long and made an observation at the end. But the fact that what they are conveying is something that has been passed down, and so they've been able to add wisdom in each generation. That's what he's doing here.
Who are those people?
What do you mean?
Well, I haven't heard any reference to his ancestors, not at the beginning.
Right.
Anything like that. So who would...
Right, and the answer is his invisible ancestors. In other words, we don't know anything about them. Maybe they're Utsians, because he's living in Utz, but I don't actually know. No, I'm 100% serious. We don't know. But I think that matters. I think that matters a great deal. I mean, certainly, as I recall, Rambam in his Mora Nevuchim, his Guide of the Perplexed, said something which we brought when we discussed the question of whether Job really lived or whether he is a parable. One of the points that that was made is that we don't have enough detail. To be real, for it to be, if you were telling a real story, we would have other information here. We have nothing. He simply shows up. So yes, there is this idea that Bildad is expressing of we need to consult our ancestors. The truth is, Bildad is saying I'm consulting my ancestors, Shuchites, bless you. And he's telling Job that's what we ought to do, but I don't know who his ancestors would be. Don't know. Okay, that's all his introduction to his metaphor. He says, go speak to the ancestors, and here we go with a parable. Now, he's going to present two parables, which I believe, like many commentators that we're going to see, should be read as two separate parables. There is a way to read it as one long one, but it seems fairly clear that it's meant to be two separate ones. You'll see as we go through it. But the first parable is sentences 11 to 15. And it is the parable of the thirsty reed, which could be a good name for a pub. Thirsty reed. Okay. Hayig'e gome belo vitsa yisge achu belimayim. He says, would a reed gome, like Moshe's boat, tevat gome, right? Will a reed become ge'e? Ge'e meaning mighty. Ashira l'Hashem ki ga'o ga'a, right? The Hashem alach ge'ut lavesh, like ga'ava, to become great, powerful. So he says, will a reed grow strong below bitza if it doesn't have swamp, if it doesn't have a place from which to be irrigated? Yisge achu b'limayim, will a meadow, yisge, will it flourish without water, right? The reed needs water. Odenu bi'ibo. Now here, this sentence can be read in two different ways. I apologize. But I'm going to read it one way, and then maybe we'll come back to the other way. But odenu bi'ibo, when it is still nascent, when it's just starting out, lo yikatef, before it has reached the stage of being picked, vilifnei kol chatzir yivash, even before the chatzir is the short grass that dries out, even before the short grass dies, it is going to dry out. This reed that doesn't have a source of water, forget about it. It's not going to make it. When it is still fresh, when it is before the time for picking, it's already going to be gone. Kain orchot kol shochechei kale. So are the paths of all those who forget God. V'tikvat chanev toved. There's that word, tikva, yet again. The tikva, the hope, or the thread, as we've seen, the of the Chanef. Chanef is usually a flatterer, but in Tanakh it's often used to just mean a wicked person, and Dan Mikra believes, I think that's the general sense, that here just means a wicked person. The hope of the wicked, Toved, will be lost. So the person who is wicked is like the reed that doesn't have a source of water. You forget God, you have no source of water, and therefore you'll be cut off. Asher Yakot Kislo, Ubeit Akavish Mivtacho. Yakot also admits of multiple translations. I'm going to render it as a noun. The threads of the spider's web. The threads of the spider web are Kislo, his hope. Right? Like, remember what he said when Eliphaz said, Yiratcha Kislatecha, your Yirah is your source of strength, or has been your source of strength. Your reverence for God was your source of strength, he said. So here, he says, this wicked person makes the spider web his source of strength, his support. Ubeit Akavish Mivtacho, he makes the house of the spider his place of security. Yisha'ein al beito v'lo ya'amod. I have news for you. He's going to lean on his house and it's not going to stand. Yachzik bo v'lo yakum. He's going to hold on to it and it will not endure. That's his first parable. Clear? Clear as mud? What he's saying is, and no matter what translation you use, this is the method. This is the message. What he's saying is, the person who doesn't have God is going to collapse. We can debate how to read one way, the other way, but that's the fundamental message that you were always going to come out with from this parable. The sentence 12 does admit of two explanations. It depends on where you put the comma. Fundamentally. But Dat Mikra's read is the way that I gave it. Odenu bi'ibo, while it is still fresh and young, lo yikatev, before it has reached the stage of picking. Rashi reads it differently. I actually brought you both on the sheet. Actually, I didn't realize that, or I would have just told you to look at that. 8, 9, and 10. 8, before its time has come to be plucked. That's Dat Mikra, right? When it is still fresh, before the time has come for it to be plucked. Rashi, on the other hand, says, when it is still fresh, and it has not been severed, it has not been plucked, I should say, Rashi says, it will be neither broken nor severed. Now what they're doing is actually something very important here. What Dat Mikra and Rashi are doing is, because they're differing on a substantive point within this message that affects how I read the second metaphor also. So this matters a great deal. That's why I took the time of doing 8, 9, 10 on your sheet. So let's see if we can get this. With a whiteboard it would be ideal, but you're going to have to imagine the whiteboard behind me. With the way that Dat Mikra reads it, what he's saying is, when the reed is still young, before it's time for being picked, already it will dry out. Does it ever then have a time when things are good? This reed? No. There's never a time that's good for this reed. Rashi disagrees. Rashi says no. Odenu bi'ibo, when it is still fresh, lo yikatef, it will not be plucked. When it's young, things are going to be good. But in the end, lefnei kol chatzir yivash. In the end, yeah, it's going to dry out before the rest of the grass. The Dat Mikra read says that this first metaphor is saying the wicked will never get anything. They're doomed from the outset. Rashi is saying that the first metaphor is telling us in the beginning things are good, and then they go south. Then after that, things are trouble. This is going to matter greatly in terms of explaining the message of the parable. As he goes on to say, the one who forgets God will collapse, right? And here he takes a dig at Job in sentence 13 when he says, the tikva of the wicked will be lost. Remember that Job said in the previous chapter, I have no tikva, I have no hope. So he says, well, the hope of the wicked collapses, Job. Yep, call it like you see it. That's his statement. I'm not gonna bother with Yakot and the two explanations of Yakot, just because it'll distract. But the point is, he says, you rely on the spider's web for your support. That's where you draw your strength. But God is the source of life. like the water that the plants need. And if you're going to try to go it on your own, you're not going to succeed. Now take a look at Ralbag in source number not. I didn't bring it. Never mind. But Ralbag says, as Rashi does, that the point is deeper. It's not just that God is the source of life. It's that the reed thrives early on, but it will dry out. The wicked might seem to thrive, but in the end, their destruction will come. Which is very important to Bildad, because Bildad spends a lot of time, more in his second speech, talking about how the wicked suffer, and how the wicked will indeed be doomed. So what we're seeing here is a precursor to that. But the reason why this is such a big deal is that it affects whether I view both parables as one message or as two messages, and it changes entirely the way I read the second parable. I'm going to take the remaining couple of minutes just to explain, without seeing it inside, we'll see it inside next time, what happens in the second parable. Whereas the first one describes a reed which grows, and then, well, a reed which is dependent on water and dries out, the second one begins by talking about a plant that is lush and everything is wonderful for it, and then it is uprooted. That's what happens in the second parable. If I take the view of Dat Mikra and others, that the first one is saying we're talking about a reed that never has any hope, then the second one is a completely separate message. Because the second one is about a plant that does do well in the beginning. And it's going somewhere, now going on a different route. And so we're going to have to ask, well then what is this different message in number two? But if I take Rashi's view of the first one, that it's about a plant that does well in the beginning and then it dies, the second one is just a reiteration of the first. And they're all one big message, which is, you can only go so far on your own, and you need to rely on God. So that's the difference in terms of whether this is one message or two messages. But it's going to be even deeper than that, as we'll see when we get into the second parable. There's a key thought that's going to emerge from it. We're out of time to be able to do that today. That's why I wanted to try to get it all into one. I thought that it would be good, but did not succeed. There's always next week. Thank you very much.